17 minutes to 10 o'clock. The South African Police Service issuing a statement late yesterday afternoon saying that any theories around the possible causes of the death of those 21 young people in East London at the In Your Benny tavern are incorrect and have not been confirmed. That was a statement that was issued by the South African Police Service yesterday. It said, and I'm going to read just a little bit for you, until such time that the work of the forensic laboratory is concluded, any informal and unofficial information which is not released by the South African Police Service must be regarded as falsehood and misleading to the public and the affected deceased families. This after there were reports yesterday that people who lost their lives at the In Your Benny tavern was largely because of carbon monoxide poisoning, because there was apparently a generator in the building in this very closed and unventilated space. That's a story that ran in news media. South African Police Services saying that is not the case. But how do you even go about starting to piece together the puzzles of a tragedy of this scale? I'm talking about everything from toxicology, everything from chemical analysis to even interviewing the witnesses. It's a lot of police work that needs to be done. So we've asked forensic investigator, independent forensic investigator, Paul O'Sullivan. He's not involved in this case, but he's offering us his opinion on just how police would go about starting to investigate this tragedy. Paul, thanks so much for joining us again here on The Morning Review. There are a few things that I would guess would need to be done. Lots of interviews with eyewitnesses, but also the toxicology and the post-mortem reports would also give us ideas of what exactly happened at 4 a.m. on Sunday morning in East London.
Yes, thanks. Look, just to correct you slightly, I'm not offering my advice. I was called and asked if I would.
You're offering your advice after we called you. Let's state it clear. You're not involved in the investigation. We just want someone who knows about these things to explain to us how these things go about.
Look, any investigation, whether it's a murder scene or a robbery or whatever, all these investigations, they start at the crime scene. And that's, you know, the starting point. So, and it's the most urgent starting point, because crime scenes can yield up a lot of evidence. Now, where you have a number of people that have passed away, as in this case, it's clear that there is a crime scene. At this stage, nobody knows what the actual crime is, but you can't have a situation with that number of people passing away and you can't say it's an accident. Even if it does turn out to be misadventure, for example, you mentioned a generator, maybe there's a gas heater, there can be anything like that. Even if it does turn out to be like that, it's still probably a crime, because The person who switched on the gas heater or switched on the generator, that person may be guilty of the offense of culpable homicide because he was reckless or negligent, and his recklessness or negligence led to the death of those persons. Now, when the deceased are carried away from a crime scene like that, there'll be a lot of photographs taken, and then the deceased will be taken to the mortuary, and then there will be what we call a post-mortem, which, if you translate it from Latin, it means after death. It's an examination of the body to see if there's any clues there that may give the investigators. And they start with the outside clothing, you know, that the deceased are wearing, and then they get down to the body itself. And they normally, in a case like this, they would normally take the stomach contents and they would normally take the blood samples. I would see no reason to do anything other than that, because it's not like you find a single body and you have to examine it. When you see that all these persons now, from what I can understand from the media reports, and bearing in mind you can't always trust the media reports, but from what I can understand, some of the persons involved, their tongues were swollen, and in one or two cases their tongues were sticking out. Mm. Now, that would indicate some sort of poisoning. And I suppose the police are looking at that. That seems to me the most logical thing to do. And it's a bit of a process because you can't just make assumptions. What you can do is you can find clues on the time on the crime scene. Now, some clues are what we call time-specific. For example, I can walk into a crime scene where somebody's just been shot. And if I examine that crime scene properly, I may pick up, for example, that there are three glasses on the table and two of them have ice in the glass. Now, if I came 2 hours later, there'd only be water in those glasses. So I might go in the kitchen and find that the kettle is still hot or that the oven is still warm. So these are what we call time-sensitive clues. They're clues which would indicate that certain things did happen. A classic case I remember now, when I was a police official and I did a crime scene at a murder scene, and when I got there, there was only one body. There was no other people around. The neighbors heard a gunshot. And when I got there, there were two glasses on the bar, and both glasses had alcohol and ice cubes in them. And lo and behold, the investigation centered around those two glasses because they had fingerprints on them. And the suspect left his fingerprints on one of the glasses with ice cubes. So we were able to say then with a fair degree of certainty that he was there immediately before the murder took place. Mm. Now, those are the sort of things we look at. And in this case, I think the police need to be given a little bit of time. I happen to know that the police in that province have a very good forensics capability, and I believe that sooner or later they will issue their report to whoever they issue it to, and then it will become public knowledge.
What questions, Paul, would detectives be asking of people who were inside and also people who were outside? And of course, those answers would be all be from their personal experience. Those questions or those answers would all be subjective. The people who were outside of their building would have a very different experience to those who are inside the building. But how do you ask questions from a detective point of view to get a broader understanding of what happened that night?
Yes, well, you have to remove any subjectivity. So you have to ask the witnesses questions where you don't give them an indication of what you want the outcome to the question to be. So you would ask, for example, did you see anything? What did you see? Were the lights on? Were the lights off? Were there any noise coming from there? Those are the sort of questions you would ask. You wouldn't ask them questions that would invite them to say yes or no. And then the people that were on the inside that had survived, I would certainly be inclined to obtain blood samples from them because if there was a carbon monoxide poisoning or any kind of poisoning, there may be traces in the blood of those individuals. Now, a number of people went to hospital and were released. I would certainly, the hospitals would have done blood tests on those. I would be looking at those blood tests to see whether there's any CO, which is carbon monoxide, whether there's any CO in their blood samples. Now, the average person would have a CO in their blood of about between, let's say, 0.5 and 1.5%. If you're a heavy smoker, it might be 2% or 2.5%. If you're suffering from certain illnesses that may induce you to absorb carbon monoxide, you may have a higher percentage. But generally speaking, if they started taking blood samples from those individuals and they find that lots of them have got high levels of carbon monoxide in their blood, that would be a big red flag. And then that would point back to, for example, you mentioned a generator. Mm. Now, I'm not aware of what's gone on at the crime scene. I've not been near the place. I only know what I've seen in the media. And as I say, you have to take with a pinch of salt what you see in the media. So at the end of the day, I'm fairly confident they'll get to the bottom of it. Of course, we all want to know quickly, but regrettably, that's not the world we live in.
Yeah.
We have to wait for the outcome. And I do know that the police have the ability, and I'm pretty sure we'll, if, what is it today, Thursday, Friday, probably by Monday we'll know what they all passed away from.
Paul, just if you were to take the story of all the report of this was a incident of carbon monoxide poisoning, what, how would that represent within a victim? What would be something that revelers or people in a confined space, particularly if this is a party, so in a party there's lots of energy, there's alcohol, there's a good vibe. What would be the first hints that something could be amiss?
Well, the thing about carbon monoxide poisoning is there is a smell. If I take you into a closed space and there's a generator or something running in there, you will be able to smell the fumes. Now, the problem is if you're drinking alcohol and stuff like that and you know there's a generator running, you may ignore the fumes or you may ignore the smell. And if you do that, it's a problem because carbon monoxide poisoning is insidious. It's like hypoxia. Hypoxia is where you, for example, you pass away from a lack of oxygen to the brain.
So, now, so you get affected by it without knowing you're being affected.
That's correct. Mm. And the problem is, if you're dancing and stuff like that, you're going to increase the absorption rate of the carbon monoxide. So it can be a little bit problem. Now, one of the things I would be looking at, and I'm sure the police are busy doing it, is looking at the load shedding schedules in that area. Now, the load shedding schedules would indicate what time the electricity went off at and what time it came on at. I can't imagine for the life of me that all these people would be dancing in the dark. So that would indicate that they probably did have some sort of either standby generator or some battery backup or something like that. So that would all have to be looked at. As I say, I'm not leading the investigation. I'm not involved in the investigation, but I do feel I have every confidence that the Forensic Services Division of the police in that province are very capable, and they'll get to the bottom of it.
And Paul, I appreciate just not your intimate experience, but your general industry experience for helping us. And while we wait for the outcome of this post-mortem and an announcement on the cause of death, you've helped us piece together how police conduct their work in trying to help unfold this very intricate this intricate investigation.
Now, the secret is the crime scene. Always, 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 every investigation, the beginning of it is the crime scene, or where the incident takes place. And if you try to investigate a matter without going to the crime scene, you're not really going to get very far.
Paula Sullivan, independent forensic investigator, not involved with the In Your Beanie Tavern case, but agreeing to talk to us of how police go about trying to find answers in a tragedy of this magnitude. 021-446-0567. You can drop me a WhatsApp, 072-567-1567.